Chapter 64. Serial Killers. The term serial killer was invented by FBI agent Robert Ressler. He got the idea from an unnamed police lecturer at Bram's Hill, the British Police Academy, who was discussing crimes in series, such as burglaries, rapes and arson. This was in the mid-1970s, and by that time American criminologists were already aware that a new type of murderer had appeared, someone who killed casually and repeatedly, usually for sex. One of the worst examples had happened in Houston, in Texas, in the early 1970s. On August the 8th, 1973, a youth who identified himself as Elmer Wayne Henley telephoned the police department and said that he had just killed a man. The police arrived to find three frightened teenagers, two boys and a girl, on the doorstep of a suburban house, and a naked, dead man lying in the hall with two bullet holes in his shoulder and back. This was what remained of Dean Call. Henley explained how he and the two friends had arrived at Call's house at 3 o'clock in the morning for a glue-sniffing session. Soon, all three were unconscious. When they came to, they were handcuffed to boards. Call was a homosexual and was furious with Henley for bringing a girl along and told him he intended to kill him. "But first," said Call, "I'm going to have my fun." And by that he meant torturing and killing them. Henley finally succeeded in sweet-talking Call into releasing them, promising to help kill the other two. They were stripped, and Call ordered Henley at gunpoint to rape the girl, Rhonda Williams. Henley tried, but was incapable. While Call was concentrating on the other youth, 16-year-old Timothy Curley, Henley grabbed the gun. "Go on, kill me," taunted Call. And Henley did just that. It seemed a straightforward case. Wayne Henley had been Call's lover and procured young boys for him. But under interrogation, Henley made an appalling admission that most of the boys he had procured had ended up tied to the same boards and were tortured and raped and then murdered. Later that day, Henley took the police to a rented boat shed in southwest Houston, and they began to dig. Very soon, they uncovered the corpse of a teenage youth wrapped in plastic, the first of 17 that were found there. One policeman described it as wall-to-wall bodies. And then Henley led the police to a site near Lake Sam Rayburn, where more corpses were uncovered. The final count was 27, although Henley was certain that there were four more bodies somewhere, making 31 in all. Henley mentioned another teenager named David Brooks, who had introduced him to Call. And when Brooks and Henley were under interrogation, it became clear that both had assisted in the murders, as well as procuring the victims. Call had paid them $200 each for them. The youngest was a 9-year-old boy. Dean Call had been a mother's boy who grew up in Indiana during World War II. He had been a sickly child and had often stayed away from school. Later, after a period in the forces, during which he realised he was homosexual, he worked for his mother manufacturing candy. When he moved to Dallas with his mother, he worked for the Power and Light Company. And then he began organising glue-sniffing parties, which sometimes ended in rape and later in murder. And eventually, murder became a habit, a requiem that would serve for any number of serial killers. Wayne Henley and David Brooks were brought to trial for their part in the murders, and both were sentenced to life imprisonment. Of course, there had always been serial killers. Gilles de Rais, for example, a French nobleman of the 15th century, killed and disembowelled more than 50 children. Jack the Ripper, who terrorised the East End of London in 1888, is probably the first of the modern serial killers. But before the mid-1970s, obsessional criminals like the Ripper were lumped together with calculating killers like the French Bluebeard Landru or the American H.H. Holmes, both of whom killed for profit. For Robert Ressler, a serial killer was someone who killed repeatedly and obsessively, almost invariably for sex, and who just went on killing until caught. Once more, it was clear that America was producing an alarming number of such cases. One such case was the sex killer who terrorised Boston from 1962 to 1964, raping and strangling 13 women, whose ages ranged from 19 to 75. He remained uncaught until in March 1965 a murderer called George Nassar, who was in Bridgewater State Hospital, a mental institution for the criminally insane, told the attorney F. Lee Bailey that the Boston strangler was a fellow prisoner named Albert DeSalvo, who was confined as a rapist who had been called the Green Man. DeSalvo was a powerfully built ex-soldier who was hyper-sexed. He needed sex as often as a dozen times a day. In 1960, he had been arrested for talking his way into women's apartments, claiming to be from a modelling agency and asking to take their measurements. He never assaulted them, he simply measured them with a tape measure. But indignant women who had been promised modelling jobs, and sometimes paid in advance with sex, reported him to the police. And the measuring man spent a short period in prison. In Bridgewater, DeSalvo confessed freely to the Strangler killings, and his intimate knowledge of details known only to the police left no one in any doubt that he was the killer. Oddly enough, it seemed that DeSalvo's murder spree had cured him of the need to kill, for he moved on to rape, and one victim had been able to give a good enough description to lead to his arrest. Sentenced to life imprisonment for the rapes, though not for the murders, Albert DeSalvo was stabbed to death in the Walpole State Prison on November the 26th, 1973. His killer was never identified. Another serial killer was just embarking on his career of murder in 1974 when Wayne Henley and David Brooks were being tried in Texas. His name was Ted Bundy, and he was a good-looking, intelligent law student whose manner was so plausible that people who saw him in court felt that he must have been misidentified. Bundy is an interesting example of a curious modern phenomenon that might be called the high IQ killer. Despite his appearance, like the Boston Strangler and Dean Cole before him, Bundy was driven by an insatiable appetite for sex. Theodore Robert Bundy had been a romantic fantasist since childhood, dreaming of fame and greatness. He also became a habitual thief, stealing expensive sports equipment such as skis. In his teens, he became a compulsive masturbator and a devotee of hard porn. But the turning point in his life was undoubtedly the evening he glanced into a lighted room on the campus of the University of Seattle and saw a girl undressing. This so excited him that he became an obsessive peeping Tom. One evening he stalked a woman leaving a bar, intending to knock her unconscious with an iron bar and to rape her. But she went into a nearby house. He was horrified at what he had almost done and vowed that he would never do it again. He later felt that he had become a Jekyll and Hyde at the mercy of a destructive self that he called the Hunchback. But the need to watch girls undressing had become an addiction. One night in 1973, after watching a girl undress, he found a door open and he went into her room. She screamed and he fled. But the next time, on January the 4th, 1974, when he found an open door, he went into the bedroom of the girl's student, knocked her unconscious with a bar wrenched from the bed frame, and then rammed the bar into her vagina. The girl eventually recovered after a week in a coma. 3 weeks later, on January the 31st, 1974, he found his way into the room of 21-year-old Linda Ann Healy and abducted her at knife point. He drove her to Taylor Mountain, 20 miles from Seattle, and spent the night raping her and acting out his sexual fantasies, which by now had a distinctly sadistic cast. Finally, he bludgeoned her to death. Now Bundy went on a killing spree. 6 young girls vanished between March 1974 and June 1974, and on July the 14th, 2 girls vanished on the same day from a picnic resort in Lake Sammamish Park. A young man wearing his arm in a sling had been seen approaching a blonde girl named Janice Ott, introducing himself as Ted and asking her to help him load a boat onto his car. She went with him and vanished. A few hours later, a teenager named Denise Nasland also vanished on her way to the toilet in the park. In October 1974, the disappearances shifted from Seattle to Salt Lake City, Utah, where Bundy had moved as a law student. 3 girls vanished in a month. But in early November, one of Bundy's intended victims escaped. Her name was Carol DeRonche, and she now told the police how a young man claiming to be a policeman had approached her in a shopping centre, told her that a thief had been caught breaking into her car, and asked her to go with him to the police station. In his Volkswagen, he had pointed a gun at her and tried to handcuff her, but she fought her way out, and then, when another car came by, the Volkswagen drove off. She was able to describe her assailant in detail. And that same evening, a 17-year-old high school student named Debbie Kent was abducted in the school car park and vanished. The Utah police had received a tip-off that Bundy could be the serial kidnapper, but he was only one of 2,000 suspects. And then, between January the 12th, 1975, and August the 23rd, 5 more girls vanished in Utah and in Colorado. In the early hours of August the 16th, 1975, a police patrolman saw a Volkswagen pull out suddenly into the road and drive off at top speed. He chased it and finally forced it to halt. The driver was Ted Bundy, and there were burgling tools in his car as well as a ski mask. Carol Daronche identified Bundy as her would-be abductor, and hairs found in his car proved to be identical with that of another victim, Melissa Smith. Bundy was charged with murder. Nearly 2 years later, while in custody, he escaped briefly from the law library in Aspen, Colorado, where he was allowed to study, but was soon caught. On December the 30th, 1977, he escaped again by sawing a hole in his ceiling with a hacksaw blade, and he made his way to Florida. He might have remained at liberty, except for his obsession with sex. On the night of January the 15th, 1978, he broke into a student's rooming house in Tallahassee and attacked four women, one after the other. Margaret Bowman was strangled with pantyhose. Liza Levy died on her way to hospital, and two more girls recovered from bludgeon attacks. Bundy moved on to another student's rooming house and fractured the skull of Cheryl Thomas. He was interrupted and fled. The last victim was a 12-year-old schoolgirl named Kimberly Leach. Bundy succeeded in kidnapping her from her school in Jacksonville on February the 9th, 1978, and raped and killed her in a remote, abandoned shack. 3 days later, he was arrested by a policeman who noticed his erratic driving. When he admitted his identity, the police looked blank. They had never heard of the much-publicised Ted Bundy. Bundy's decision to move to Florida was fatal. Florida had the death penalty. Convicted on July the 23rd, 1979, Bundy was electrocuted, after many appeals, on January the 24th, 1989. The crowd outside the prison carried banners reading, "Let Bundy Fry." In 1979, Chicagoans were shocked by a case that in many ways resembled that of Dean Call. After the disappearance of 15-year-old Robert Peast, a contractor named John Wayne Gacy was questioned by the police. Peast had been intending to call on him to ask for a job. The smell of decaying flesh led the police to dig in the crawl space under Gacy's home, where they found seven bodies, all of young men and parts of others. Gacy would finally admit to killing 33 young men. He was well known in his neighbourhood as a good Samaritan and often appeared at children's parties dressed as a clown. Gacy, born in 1942, had once been married and the manager of a fried chicken business belonging to his in-laws. But charges of attempted sodomy and battery led to a 10-year jail sentence. Released after 18 months as a model prisoner, he moved to Chicago and became a successful building contractor, even being photographed in 1978 with President Carter's wife, Rosalynn, at a civic function. It was after his second wife left him in 1976 that he began killing. If the victim, who had been lured to his home, made no objection to being sodomised, he was allowed to go. If not, he ended in the crawl space or in the river. Gacy was executed by lethal injection at Joliet Penitentiary on the 10th of May 1994. It was not until 1983 that the American public suddenly became aware of the menace of the serial killer. In a Texas jail in the early hours of June the 15th, 1983, a drifter named Henry Lee Lucas called for his jailer and declared that he wanted to confess to murder. In the office of the local sheriff, he stated that he thought that he had killed more than 100 people. Describing a 4-year murder spree with his partner and lover, Otis Toole, Lucas ended by claiming that his total number of victims amounted to 360. Born to a poor family in Virginia in 1937, Lucas had often been abused during childhood by his drunken mother, who had once hit him so hard with a piece of wood that he was unconscious for 3 days. He also lost an eye in a classroom accident. One of his mother's many lovers taught him to kill a calf by cutting its throat as he sodomised it. After periods in reformatory and in prison, Lucas killed his mother during a quarrel. For this, he spent 10 years in prison, being released in June 1960. He was later to claim that he warned the prison authorities that he would kill if he was released, and that he had killed a woman at random the same day. A marriage to a woman with two daughters ended when Lucas had sex with both children. When he met his partner in crime, Otis Toole, in Jacksonville, Florida, in 1977, Lucas claimed that he had already committed half a dozen murders. He explained later that he was angry at the world and wanted to express his resentment. Toole was an effeminate pyromaniac, and the two of them killed casually as they travelled from Texas to Michigan. The victims were often store owners who were unfortunate enough to be alone when the two came in. They moved on so quickly that they were usually hundreds of miles away when the bodies were discovered. In a typical killing in November 1978, the two picked up a couple whose car had broken down, Kevin Key and Rita Salazar. Toole shot the youth once in the head, and Lucas shot the girl six times. Whether rape took place is not clear. By this time, the couple were killing for fun. In 1980, Lucas and Toole took with them Toole's younger sister, Becky, and brother, Frank. Nine-year-old Becky would soon become Lucas's mistress, and the two children witnessed a number of killings and even helped to bury the bodies. In 1982, Lucas was paid to look after an 88-year-old woman named Kate Rich, and he and Becky joined in a fundamentalist sect called the House of Prayer in Texas. But when Becky decided that she wanted to go back to Florida to finish a sentence in reformatory, they quarrelled, and Lucas killed her. For Lucas, this murder seems to have been the beginning of the end. Back in Texas, he took Kate Rich for a drive and then murdered and raped her. Arrested for carrying a gun, a felony for an ex-convict, Lucas had a religious conversion in prison and attempted suicide. His confession followed. The case gripped America. Even though various lawmen were inclined to believe that Lucas had killed nowhere near 360, however, about 157 were eventually confirmed. Lucas and Toole were both sentenced to death. Toole died in prison in 1996 of liver failure. Lucas is still in custody at the time of writing. 1997. The case of the multiple sex killer Gerald Gallego is of interest mainly because Gallego's partner in crime, middle-class Charlene Williams, was as involved as he was. Gallego, an ex-convict whose father had been executed for the murder of a police officer, had been married seven times by the time he met Charlene in 1977. She was the only daughter of a wealthy Sacramento businessman and had been married and divorced twice, and had been acquainted with drugs and sex since her teens. She was fascinated by the machismo of the little, swaggering convict, and soon they were married. But she had strong lesbian tendencies, and when Gallego caught her in bed with a female guest, he found that his sexual prowess dwindled. The only person with whom he remained potent was his teenage daughter, with whom he'd been having sex since she was seven. It's not clear who was responsible for the idea of kidnapping girls and forcing them to engage in sex, then killing them, although one writer names Charlene. Between 1978 and 1980, they kidnapped three pairs of girls and killed them after sex. In 1980, two more women, one 5 months pregnant, were killed. The murder spree came to an end when they kidnapped a couple, Beth Sowers and Craig Miller, outside a restaurant in Sacramento. Miller was quickly killed with a bullet in the head. Beth was murdered after being forced to submit to sex with both kidnappers all night. But a student who saw the abduction noted down the number of the car. It was registered in the name of Charlene Williams. The couple fled, but were arrested 2 weeks later when Charlene asked her parents to wire her some money. Gallego was sentenced to death. Charlene received 16 years in prison. The case bears an obvious resemblance to the English Moore's murder case of the 1960s. Eileen Wuornos, known as Lee, has often been labelled the world's first female serial killer. But in the sense defined above, as someone with an obsessive compulsion to violence, this is inaccurate. Lee Wuornos was a hard-drinking lesbian, noted for her aggressiveness when drunk. She had been in jail for holding up a store, and she lived from prostitution. When she moved from Michigan to Florida, she began to hang out in a biker's bar. In 1986, after meeting the love of her life, Tyria Moore, in a gay bar in Daytona Beach, she announced that she regarded herself as Tyria's husband and would support her. But as her looks had begun to fade and her waistline to expand, she decided that it would be simpler to kill men with whom she hitched a ride and then to take their money and their cars. And so, in 1990, the Florida police found themselves baffled by a series of murders of males killed with the same small-calibre handgun. The victims included an electrician, a construction worker, a rodeo worker, a truck driver, and even an official child abuse investigator. When, in July 1990, a car was driven off the road by two drunken women and then abandoned, it was recognised as belonging to a part-time missionary named Peter Seams, who was 65 and who had vanished in June. Suddenly, the police began to suspect that their serial killer could be a woman, even two. Then investigators found some belongings of a victim named Richard Mallory, and the thumbprint on a pawn ticket, obligatory in Florida, was identified as that of Eileen Vornos. Tyria Moore was arrested first and agreed to help the police in return for immunity. She seems to have taken no part in the murders. After Vornos was arrested, Moore persuaded her to confess. Vornos insisted that it was not murder, that she had killed her victims, seven of them, because every one of them had beat and raped her. The sheer implausibility of this defence ensured her conviction, and at the time of writing, she's on death row. 6 months after Vornos's arrest, America was stunned by the gruesome details of another serial murder case. On July the 22nd, 1991, two police patrolmen driving along a street in Milwaukee saw a black man running towards them, a handcuff dangling from one wrist. He babbled hysterically about a madman who'd been about to kill him. The police allowed him to lead them to an address in a slum apartment block, and the door was answered by a tall, good-looking young white man who gave his name as Jeffrey Dahmer. He seemed so calm that the police were convinced this was a false alarm, until they smelt the distinct odour of decaying flesh that wafted from the apartment. When the police tried to enter, Dahmer became hysterical and had to be handcuffed. Within minutes, the police realised that they had discovered a mixture of a slaughterhouse and a torture chamber. A freezer contained a plastic bag with a human head in it. A box contained severed male hands and genitals. There were no fewer than five skulls, while a barrel contained three male torsos. There was also an electric saw stained with blood and a barrel full of a sticky substance that proved to contain acid, which had been used to dissolve flesh. Dahmer confessed that flesh wrapped neatly in the refrigerator was intended for eating. He preferred it with mustard. The black man, Tracy Edwards, explained that he had met Dahmer in a shopping mall and had accepted his invitation to a party. After drinking beer, and then rum and cola, Edwards felt sleepy. When Dahmer tried to embrace him, Edwards said he was leaving, and Dahmer snapped a handcuff on his wrist. After that, they watched a video of The Exorcist, while Dahmer held a large butcher's knife against him. When Dahmer announced that he intended to cut his heart out and to eat it, Edwards succeeded in hitting him and escaping. At the police station, Dahmer confessed to killing 17 males and eating parts of their bodies. Born in 1960, a witness to constant fights between his middle-class parents, Dahmer had committed his first murder when he was 18. Alone in the house, he had invited a hitchhiker in for drinks and then bludgeoned him to death when he tried to leave. He had buried the body in the woods. 3 years in the army ended in a discharge for drunkenness. He moved to Milwaukee and discovered the gay bars. He was banned from one of them for slipping a drug into his companion's drink. In September 1987, after a year on probation for exposing himself to two boys, he picks up 24-year-old Stephen Tuomi, spent a night with him in a hotel bedroom, and strangled him. Dahmer claimed that he couldn't remember the killing. He put the body in a trunk and took it to his grandmother's house, where he had a basement flat. And there he dismembered the body and stuffed the pieces in plastic bags, which he then put out for garbage collection. For the next 4 years, it was a monotonous story of inviting men and boys, mostly black, back to his apartment, drugging them and killing them, and eating parts of their bodies. Meanwhile, Dahmer worked in a chocolate factory and saw his probation officer regularly. She felt that he was progressing well. In the week before his arrest, he killed and dismembered two black men and had obviously intended the same fate for Tracy Edwards. In February 1993, Dahmer was sentenced to life imprisonment. On November the 28th, 1994, he was killed in jail by being hit on the head with an iron bar by a fellow prisoner. Like so many serial killers, Dahmer was dogged by a sense of futility. He remarked after his sentence, "I couldn't find any meaning in my life when I was out there. I'm sure as hell not going to find it in here." Dahmer's case bears a strong resemblance to that of the Scottish serial killer Dennis Nilsson, a civil servant who began to kill in November of 1978 in his flat in Muswell Hill in North London. His method was the same as Dahmer's, to invite male pickups back to his flat, to get them drunk, usually on vodka, and then to strangle them. He claims that he never had sex with the bodies. In February 1983, an engineer was called to the house to investigate a blocked drain, and he found human flesh. Arrested on his return home, Nilsson confessed to killing 15 or 16? In fact, 15. Two severed heads, a skull, half a male torso and various body parts were found in cupboards. He had removed the flesh from the skull by boiling it. But Nilsson apparently was not a cannibal. He told his biographer, Brian Masters, "I am an egg and bacon man myself." Nilsson was a lonely, introverted homosexual who claimed that he had killed for company. He was sentenced to life imprisonment. Russia's most notorious serial killer, Andrei Shikatilo, committed 53 murders over 14 years, from November 1978 until November 1990. An intelligent man, a schoolteacher and a Communist Party member, Chikatilo's problem was that he was sexually impotent under normal circumstances. In November 1978, when he was 42, Chikatilo picked up 9-year-old Lena Zakotnova, and when she admitted a desire to visit the toilet, invited her into the shack that he had rented. He lived elsewhere in Rostov with his wife and daughter. There, he choked her and tried to rape her, but he was unable to achieve an erection. He ejaculated anyway and pushed his semen into her with his fingers. The blood of her ruptured hymen induced another orgasm, and he stabbed her again and again with a jackknife. Chikatilo had finally discovered how to achieve full sexual satisfaction, by stabbing and violating his victims. He threw Lena's body into a nearby river, and another man, with a record of sex crime, was charged and executed. It was 2 years before Chikatilo killed again. In September 1981, he picked up 17-year-old Larissa Tkachenko, a school truant who was willing to offer sex in exchange for a meal. In the woods, he bludgeoned her unconscious with his huge fists, bit off one of her nipples, and ejaculated over the corpse. Chikatilo found that he achieved equal ecstasy when killing boys, and the majority of his victims were male or female teenagers, although some were children and some older women, including an ex-girlfriend and her child. He enjoyed torturing and mutilating the victims. Arrested on suspicion in 1984, Chikatilo's luck held. His semen was type AB, while his blood type was A, and he was released. Finally, in 1990, when a victim was found in woods near a small country station, a policeman recalled a man in a grey suit who had come out of the woods looking dishevelled, and who had shown his identification papers on request. It had been Andrei Chikatilo, and he was now placed under surveillance until the police decided that he was too dangerous to allow to wander at large and arrested him. After days of relentless questioning, he confessed. His trial on a charge of 53 murders opened in April 1992. He was found guilty of 52. It would have been embarrassing to find him guilty of murder for which another man had been executed, and he was executed in his turn by a bullet in the back of the head in February of 1994. England's most notorious case of serial murder also came to light in February 1994, when police with a search warrant arrived at the home of a builder called Fred West at 25 Cromwell Street in Gloucester. His 16-year-old daughter, Heather, had vanished in May of 1987, and the Wests, Fred and his plump wife, Rose, claimed that she had run away from home. But West was suspected of having sex with another daughter, and the persistence of a policewoman, Hazel Savage, finally led to the search. In police custody, West, 52, admitted murdering Heather during a quarrel. The following day, her remains were found at the bottom of the garden. But the police went on digging, and soon they unearthed another corpse, that of a lodger, Shirley Ann Robinson. Eventually, seven more female bodies were found in the garden and under the floor of the house. The remains of West's first wife, Rena, who had been missing for 25 years, were found buried in a field near West's childhood home in the village of Much Markle. The remains of Rena's daughter, Charmaine, were found at the previous address. The remains of Anne McFall, West's mistress and a friend of his first wife, were also found buried in a field. Most of the victims were girls who had either been lodgers at 25 Cromwell Street or who had been abducted off the street. The police were soon convinced that Rose West was as involved as her husband. In 1972, they had offered a lift to Caroline Rain, their former au pair, and they had taken her back to Cromwell Street, where she was forced into lesbian sex with Rose and then raped twice by Fred. Incredibly, the magistrate let them off with a fine. It was after this close shave that the Wests began killing the girls they sexually assaulted, in a partnership that resembles that of Gerald Gallego and Charlene Williams. The girls were often suspended upside down from the basement ceiling, and the number of fingers found separated from the skeletons suggests that, amongst other sadistic activities, West enjoyed cutting off body parts while the victim was alive. West's eldest child, Anne Marie, told how she had been deflowered with a vibrator when she was 8 and then treated as a sex toy by both parents until, after being impregnated by her father, she left home in her mid-teens. Heather was killed because she wanted to leave home. Her father had been raping her constantly. Another sister, May, had lost her virginity when she was 8, almost certainly to her father's brother, John, a dustman, who would later commit suicide. West hanged himself in prison on New Year's Day 1995, and for a while there was doubt whether there was enough evidence to proceed with the case against his widow. But the trial evidence that showed that Rose had participated in rape and sadism made it clear that she was lying when she claimed that she knew absolutely nothing of the murders. In November 1995, she was sentenced to life imprisonment. In the early 1990s, it became apparent that there was a serial sex killer operating in the area of Sydney, Australia. 7 hitchhikers had vanished between December 1989 and April 1992. And when skeletal remains of one couple, James Gibson and Deborah Everest, were found in the Balango State Forest, the press labelled the killer the backpacker murderer. Remains of 3 more of his victims were found shortly afterwards. One girl, Anya Habscheit, had been decapitated. In early 1994, police heard reports that a factory worker named Richard Millat had remarked that killing a woman was like cutting up a loaf of bread. Millat's 50-year-old brother, Ivan, was arrested on May the 22nd, 1994, and in his garage was found evidence linking him to the murders, including a sleeping bag belonging to Deborah Everest. In England, a young man named Paul Onions recalled how, in January 1990, he had been offered a lift by a slit-eyed man with a drooping moustache, who had held him at gunpoint and tried to tie him up. Onions had succeeded in fleeing. Now he heard about the Millat arrest and suspected that this must be his assailant. He flew out to Australia and identified Millat as his attacker. Many of the Millat family had police records, and Millat himself had at one time been forced to flee to New Zealand, charged with armed robbery. During his trial in 1996, it became clear that he was a control freak and that he made a habit of picking up hitchhikers, tying them up, and then raping and torturing both men and women. At the trial, it was also suggested that his brothers, Richard and Walter, were accomplices in these murders, although they were never charged. Ivan Millat was sentenced to life imprisonment. The cases described above are the most prominent and widely publicised serial murders since the 1970s, but dozens more could be added to the list. Many of these simply failed to achieve the nationwide notoriety of killers like Gacy or Dahmer. Possibly the worst serial killer of the 20th century was Donald Pee-wee Gaskins, who was electrocuted in 1991 at the age of 58. He had been sentenced to death for the contract killing of a fellow prison inmate, a man named Rudolph Tyner. Gaskins had pretended to befriend Tyner and succeeded in persuading him to talk to him over a kind of homemade telephone rigged up between their cells. But Tyner's receiver was a bomb, which blew him to pieces when Gaskin pressed a switch. Awaiting his execution, Gaskins was approached by a writer named Winton Earle, who had heard that Gaskins talked about a private graveyard. Gaskins explained that he had found that he built up a periodic tension which would result in headaches and sickness until it exploded in violence, whereafter he would feel relaxed and relieved. This, in fact, applies to virtually all serial killers. And over 18 months of taped interviews, Gaskins told such a horrifying story of murder and torture that Earle finally had a breakdown and believed that Gaskins was responsible for the cancer he subsequently developed. Gaskins estimated that he had killed about 110 people. Some were contract killings, or killings committed in the course of his involvement in the stolen car racket, but most were sadistic sex crimes, which Gaskins liked to call his coastal kills. Gaskins had been born in South Carolina, and his childhood was harsh. Sent to reform school for burglary in his mid-teens, he was regularly gang-raped. In prison a few years later, Gaskins decided that he would gain the respect he craved – he was only 5 feet tall and had a high voice – by murdering one of the most brutal hard men in the jail. It cost him years on his sentence, but he gained the respect, and he was ever afterwards regarded with a mixture of admiration and fear. After a term in jail for rape, Gaskins decided that in future he would never leave his victims alive to complain. In 1969, when a female hitchhiker declined his offer to spend the night in a motel, he killed her and then found himself totally carried away by a sadistic frenzy. From then on, Gaskins committed sadistic sex murders regularly at a rate of 12 or so a year. He liked to melt lead and to pour it into the victim's wounds, and he once sliced pieces off a girl for days until she died of shock and loss of blood. Like Milat and Chikatilo, he killed young men with as much pleasure as women. His final arrest came as a result of the murder of 13-year-old Kim Gelkins, a friend of his daughter's. She agreed to accompany him to see his sister one weekend and was raped and tortured to death. When her father searched Gaskins' trailer home, he found some of his daughter's clothes. While Gaskins was being questioned, a former friend, who had now become a born-again Christian, offered to lead police to Gaskins' private graveyard in the swampy woods, and there 5 bodies were dug up. Various plea bargains resulted in several life sentences, and Gaskins would probably have remained in jail well into the 21st century if he had not, out of bravado and boredom, accepted the contract job to kill Tina. Wilton Earl published the account of Gaskins' murders in a book called Final Truth in 1993, told entirely in Gaskins' own words. It is so nauseating that most readers probably give it up long before the end, but it establishes Gaskins as perhaps the most sadistic murderer known to criminal science. A man who might have come close to that title if he had remained at liberty is Jeff Adams, a killer whose name is totally unknown to most people, even to criminologists. In 1988, in the wealthy Los Angeles suburb of San Gabriel, Adams played a game which consisted of sending threatening notes to beautiful women who were married to rich men. They were signed Incubus. Sally Wimbush had received a dozen of these when the Incubus attacked her by the side of her own swimming pool, tied her hands and feet to a bench, and then raped her and went on to jam various objects into every orifice of her body. A bottle in her vagina, a ballpoint pen in her anus, chopsticks in her ears, and dog excrement in her mouth. She was left to suffocate to death. Yet 3 security guards had been hired to protect her. Within months, 2 more victims were raped and killed in the same horrific manner. The Incubus obviously hated rich bitches. A 4th murder attempt failed when a masked man in a black tracksuit set off a security alarm. A guard with a gun failed to prevent the man from escaping, but examination of the film taken by the security camera revealed that the intruder had brushed the gun barrel with his finger. By this time, the police finally had a suspect. The tracksuit was of a rare designer type, and the sports shop owner was able to identify the credit card receipt of the man to whom he had sold it. Jeff Adams, a softly spoken voice coach. An examination of the guard's gun barrel revealed that the fingerprint was that of Jeff Adams. A sticker in Adams' office had the inscription, "Make the bitches eat shit." He was sentenced to life imprisonment. Even less well-known is the case of the youthful serial killer Wayne Nance, whose crimes terrorised Missoula, Montana, for more than 10 years. Nance was a good-looking young man with a moody streak. He had become a murder suspect in 1974 when he was 18 years old. The minister's wife, Donna Pounds, had encountered an intruder in her home. The man had raped her at gunpoint and then made her kneel and executed her by shooting 5 times into the back of her head. Nance had been seen near the house at about the time of the murder, but there was simply no evidence to connect him to it. 2 months earlier, a 5-year-old girl named Siobhan McInnes had vanished, and her sexually assaulted body had been found in a culvert. This crime also remained unsolved. In 1968, Nance's father had gone to prison for holding up a store and pistol-whipping the owner. He'd been lucky to escape with a 5-year sentence. Subsequently, his wife committed suicide after a quarrel by driving her car into a tree. In February 1976, a local attorney named Gil Wooten was murdered with a rifle shot, and this crime also remained unsolved. And in the following April, a schoolteacher named Verna Quayle was raped in her house and stabbed to death with a kitchen knife in the chest. Rumours began to circulate that the crimes were linked to Satanism, and once again, Wayne Nance came under suspicion. By now, he had been inducted into the Navy. He spent 2 years as a sailor, but was discharged for bad behaviour. In 1978, a 15-year-old girl named Devona Nelson vanished in Seattle while Nance was visiting that city. Her bones would be discovered later near Missoula in January 1980. The bleak mountain landscape of the area made it easy to dispose of bodies. Still another skull was simply labelled Debbie Deer Creek, after the location where it was found. Later evidence revealed it to be that of a girl known simply as Robin, who had arrived in town in August of 1984 and gone to live with Wayne Nance and then vanished. Nance had always claimed that she had simply walked out. At around this time, Nance went to work for a local furniture store and became heavily enamoured of a supervisor called Chris Wells, who was married. In November 1985, Nance delivered some furniture at the remote house of a couple named Mike and Teresa Shook. On the morning of the 13th of December, a neighbour knocked at their door and received no answer. He went in and smelled smoke. Inside, there was chaos. Mike Shook had been tied up and stabbed to death. His wife had been raped and stabbed to death. And then the killer had set the house on fire to burn the evidence, including three children. But he had closed the doors, and the fire had died out for lack of oxygen. The children were all seriously ill, but later recovered. No one recalled that Nance had recently delivered furniture to the Shooks. 9 months later, after midnight on September the 3rd, 1986, Chris Wells's husband, Doug, returned home to find Wayne Nance in his front garden. Nance explained that he had seen something and asked Wells to get a torch. When Wells turned his back on him, Nance hit him on the head. As they struggled, Nance produced a Luger pistol, and Chris was forced to tie up her husband. Chris gave Nance $130, which he said he needed to leave town. Then he ordered her into a bedroom and tied her up. He forced her husband to enter the basement and then stabbed him in the chest. Wells was convinced that he would die. But when Nance left him, he realised that there was a rifle in the basement. And as Nance came back down the stairs again, Wells shot him. Then, in an incredible burst of adrenaline, he followed Nance upstairs, beating him over the head with the rifle butt. As they struggled for Nance's pistol, it went off, and Nance collapsed. He had accidentally shot himself. He died a short time later in hospital. Doug Wells recovered. Why has the last quarter of the 20th century produced an epidemic of serial killers, a plague of murder? Undoubtedly, it's because of the high level of sexual stimulation in our society. More stable societies recognise that the purpose of sexual stimulation is ultimately to produce the next generation. Japan still retains a balance between this socially responsible attitude and a pragmatic acceptance of illicit sex as an essential male outlet. Countries like England and the USA, once bastions of Puritanism, have allowed liberalisation to carry them to the opposite extreme, and the result has been an explosion of sexual violence. The only long-term answer is a more mature society, and that may lie far in the future.